Book 3, Chapter 14. The Don was a real man at the age of 12. Short, dark, slender, living in the strange Moorish-looking village of Corleone in Sicily, he had been born Vito Andolini. But when strange men came to kill the son of the man they had murdered, his mother sent the young boy to America to stay with friends. And in the new land, he changed his name to Corleone to preserve some tie with his native village. It was one of the few gestures of sentiment he was ever to make. In Sicily, at the turn of the century, the Mafia was the second government, far more powerful than the official one in Rome. Vito Corleone's father became involved in a feud with another villager who took his case to the Mafia. The father refused to knuckle under, and in a public quarrel, killed the local Mafia chief. A week later, he himself was found dead, his body torn apart by Lupara blasts. A month after the funeral, Mafia gunmen came inquiring after the young boy, Vito. They had decided that he was too close to manhood, that he might try to avenge the death of his father in the years to come. The 12-year-old Vito was hidden by relatives and shipped to America. There he was boarded with the Abbandandos, whose son Genco was later to become consigliere to his Don. Young Vito went to work in the Abbandando grocery store on 9th Avenue in New York's Hell's Kitchen. At the age of 18, Vito married an Italian girl freshly arrived from Sicily, a girl of only 16, but a skilled cook, a good housewife. They settled down in a tenement on 10th Avenue near 35th Street, only a few blocks from where Vito worked, and 2 years later were blessed with their first child, Santino, called by all his friends Sonny because of his devotion to his father. In the neighborhood lived a man called Bonucci. He was a heavy-set, fierce-looking Italian who wore expensive, light-colored suits and a cream-colored fedora. This man was reputed to be of the Black Hand, an offshoot of the Mafia, which extorted money from families and storekeepers by threat of physical violence. However, since most of the inhabitants of the neighborhood were violent themselves, Bonucci's threats of bodily harm were effective only with elderly couples without male children to defend them. Some of the storekeepers paid him trifling sums as a matter of convenience. However, Bonucci was also a scavenger on fellow criminals, people who illegally sold Italian lottery or ran gambling games in their homes. The Abbandando grocery gave him a small tribute, this despite the protests of young Genco, who told his father he would settle the Bonucci hash. His father forbade him. Vito Corleone observed all this without feeling in any way involved. One day, Bonucci was set upon by three young men who cut his throat from ear to ear, not deeply enough to kill him, but enough to frighten him and make him bleed a great deal. Vito saw Bonucci fleeing from his punishers, the circular slash flowing red. What he never forgot was Bonucci holding the cream-colored fedora under his chin to catch the dripping blood as he ran, as if he did not want his suit soiled or did not want to leave a shameful trail of carmine. But this attack proved a blessing in disguise for Bonucci. The three young men were not murderers, merely tough young boys determined to teach him a lesson and stop him from scavenging. Bonucci proved himself a murderer. A few weeks later, the knife wielder was shot to death, and the families of the other two young men paid an indemnity to Bonucci to make him forswear his vengeance. After that, the tributes became higher, and Bonucci became a partner in the neighborhood gambling games. As for Vito Corleone, it was none of his affair. He forgot about it immediately. During World War I, when imported olive oil became scarce, Bonucci acquired a part interest in the Abbandando grocery store by supplying it not only with oil, but imported Italian salami, hams, and cheeses. He then moved a nephew into the store, and Vito Corleone found himself out of a job. By this time, the second child, Frederico, had arrived, and Vito Corleone had four mouths to feed. Up to this time, he had been a quiet, very contained young man who kept his thoughts to himself. The son of the grocery store owner, young Genco Abbandando, was his closest friend, And to the surprise of both of them, Vito reproached his friend for his father's deed. Genko, flushed with shame, vowed to Vito that he would not have to worry about food, that he, Genko, would steal food from the grocery to supply his friend's needs. This offer, though, was sternly refused by Vito as too shameful, a son stealing from his father. The young Vito, however, felt a cold anger for the dreaded Fanucci. He never showed this anger in any way, but bided his time. He worked in the railroad for a few months, and then, when the war ended, work became slow, and he could earn only a few days' pay a month. Also, most of the foremen were Irish and American, and abused the workmen in the foulest language, which Vito always bore stone-faced, as if he did not comprehend, though he understood English very well, despite his accent. One evening, as Vito was having supper with his family, there was a knock on the window that led to the open-air shaft that separated them from the next building. When Vito pulled aside the curtain, he saw to his astonishment one of the young men in the neighborhood, Peter Clemenza, leaning out from a window on the other side of the air shaft. He was extending a white-sheeted bundle.
"Hey, paisan," Clemenza said, "hold these for me until I ask for them. Hurry up."
Automatically, Vito reached over the empty space of the air shaft and took the bundle. Clemenza's face was strained and urgent. He was in some sort of trouble, and Vito's helping action was instinctive. But when he untied the bundle in his kitchen, there were 5 oily guns staining the white cloth. He put them in his bedroom closet and waited. He learned that Clemenza had been taken away by the police. They must have been knocking on his door when he handed the guns over the air shaft. Vito never said a word to anyone, and of course his terrified wife dared not open her lips, even in gossip, for fear her own husband would be sent to prison. 2 days later, Peter Clemenza reappeared in the neighborhood and asked Vito casually,
"Do you have my goods still?"
Vito nodded. He was in the habit of talking little. Clemenza came up to his tenement flat and was given a glass of wine while Vito dug the bundle out of his bedroom closet. Clemenza drank his wine, his heavy, good-natured face alertly watching Vito.
"Did you look inside?"
Vito, his face impassive, shook his head.
"I'm not interested in things that don't concern me," he said.
They drank wine together the rest of the evening. They found each other congenial. Clemenza was a storyteller. Vito Corleone was a listener to storytellers. They became casual friends. A few days later, Clemenza asked the wife of Vito Corleone if she would like a fine rug for her living room floor. He took Vito with him to help carry the rug. Clemenza led Vito to an apartment house with 2 marble pillars and a white marble stoop. He used the key to open the door, and they were inside a plush apartment. Clemenza grunted,
"Go on the other side of the room and help me roll it up."
The rug was a rich red wool. Vito Corleone was astonished by Clemenza's generosity. Together, they rolled the rug into a pile, and Clemenza took one end while Vito took the other. They lifted it and started carrying it toward the door. At that moment, the apartment bell rang. Clemenza immediately dropped the rug and strode to the window. He pulled the drape aside slightly, and what he saw made him draw a gun from inside his jacket. It was only at that moment the astonished Vito Corleone realized that they were stealing the rug from some stranger's apartment. The apartment bell rang again. Vito went up alongside Clemenza so that he too could see what was happening. At the door was a uniformed policeman. As they watched, the policeman gave the doorbell a final push, then shrugged and walked away down the marble steps and down the street. Clemenza grunted in a satisfied way and said,
"Come on, let's go."
He picked up his end of the rug and Vito picked up the other end. The policeman had barely turned the corner before they were edging out the heavy oaken door and into the street with the rug between them. 30 minutes later, they were cutting the rug to fit the living room of Vito Corleone's apartment. They had enough left over for the bedroom. Clemenza was an expert workman, and from the pockets of his wide, ill-fitting jacket, Even then he liked to wear loose clothes, though he was not so fat. He took the necessary carpet-cutting tools. Time went on. Things did not improve. The Corleone family could not eat the beautiful rug. Very well, there was no work. His wife and children must starve. Vito took some parcels of food from his friend Jenko while he thought things out. Finally, he was approached by Clemenza and Tessio, another young tough of the neighborhood. They were men who thought well of him, the way he carried himself, and they knew he was desperate. They proposed to him that he become one of their gang, which specialized in hijacking trucks of silk dresses after those trucks were loaded up at the factory on 31st Street. There was no risk. The truck drivers were sensible working men who, at the sight of a gun, flopped on the sidewalk like angels while the hijackers drove the truck away to be unloaded at a friend's warehouse. Some of the merchandise would be sold to an Italian wholesaler. Part of the loot would be sold door-to-door in the Italian neighborhoods, Arthur Avenue in the Bronx, Mulberry Street, and the Chelsea District in Manhattan, all to poor Italian families looking for a bargain, whose daughters could never be able to afford such fine apparel. Clemenza and Tessio needed Vito to drive since they knew he chauffeured the Abbondanzo grocery store delivery truck. In 1919, skilled automobile drivers were at a premium. Against his better judgment, Vito Corleone accepted their offer. The clinching argument was that he would clear at least $1,000 for his share of the job. But his young companions struck him as rash, the planning of the job haphazard, the distribution of the loot foolhardy. Their whole approach was too careless for his taste, but he thought them of good, sound character. Peter Clemenza, already burly, inspired a certain trust, and the lean, saturnine Tessio inspired confidence. The job itself went off without a hitch. Vito Corleone felt no fear, much to his astonishment, when his two comrades flashed guns and made the driver get out of the silk truck. He was also impressed with the coolness of Clemenza and Tessio. They didn't get excited, but joked with the driver, told him if he was a good lad, they'd send his wife a few dresses. Because Vito thought it stupid to peddle dresses himself, and so gave his whole share of stock to the fence, he made only $700. But this was a considerable sum of money in 1919. The next day on the street, Vito Corleone was stopped by the cream-suited, white-fedored Fanucci. Fanucci was a brutal-looking man, and he had done nothing to disguise the circular scar that stretched in a white semicircle from ear to ear, looping under his chin. He had heavy black brows and coarse features which, when he smiled, were in some odd way amiable. He spoke with a very thick Sicilian accent.
"Ah, young fellow," he said to Vito, "people tell me you're rich, you and your two friends, but don't you think you've treated me a little shabbily? After all, this is my neighborhood, and you should let me wet my beak."
He used the Sicilian phrase of the mafia,
"fare bagnare a pizzo."
Pizzo means the beak of any small bird, such as a canary. The phrase itself was a demand for part of the loot. As was his habit, Vito Corleone did not answer. He understood the implication immediately and was waiting for a definite demand. Fanucci smiled at him, showing gold teeth and stretching his noose-like scar tight around his face. He mopped his face with a handkerchief and unbuttoned his jacket for a moment as if to cool himself, but really to show the gun he carried stuck in the waistband of his comfortably wide trousers. Then he sighed and said,
"Give me $500 and I'll forget the insult. After all, young people don't know the courtesies due a man like myself."
Vito Corleone smiled at him, and even as a young man still unblooded, there was something so chilling in his smile that Fanucci hesitated a moment before going on.
"Otherwise the police will come to see you, your wife and children will be shamed and destitute. Of course, if my information as to your gains is incorrect, I'll dip my beak just a little, but no less than $300. And don't try to deceive me."
For the first time, Vito Corleone spoke. His voice was reasonable, showed no anger. It was courteous, as befitted a young man speaking to an older man of Fanucci's eminence. He said softly,
"My two friends have my share of the money. I'll have to speak to them."
Fanucci was reassured.
"You can tell your two friends that I expect them to let me wet my beak in the same manner. Don't be afraid to tell them," he added reassuringly. "Clemenza and I know each other well. He understands these things. Let yourself be guided by him. He has more experience in these matters."
Vito Corleone shrugged. He tried to look a little embarrassed.
"Of course," he said. "You understand, this is all new to me. Thank you for speaking to me as a godfather."
Fanucci was impressed. "You're a good fellow," he said. He took Vito's hand and clasped it in both of his hairy ones. "You have a respect," he said. "A fine thing in the young. Next time, speak it to me first, eh? Perhaps I can help you in your plans." In later years, Vito Corleone understood that what had made him act in such a perfect, tactical way with Fanucci was the death of his own hot-tempered father who had been killed by the mafia in Sicily. But at that time, all he felt was an icy rage that this man planned to rob him of the money he had risked his life and freedom to earn. He had not been afraid. Indeed, he thought, at that moment, that Fanucci was a crazy fool. From what he had seen of Clemenza, that burly Sicilian would sooner give up his life than a penny of his loot. After all, Clemenza had been ready to kill a policeman merely to steal a rug, and the slender Tessio had the deadly air of a viper. But later that night, in Clemenza's tenement apartment across the air shaft, Vito Corleone received another lesson in the education he had just begun. Clemenza cursed, Tessio scowled, but then both men started talking about whether Fanucci would be satisfied with $200. Tessio thought he might. Clemenza was positive.
"No, that Scarface bastard must have found out what we made from the wholesaler who bought the dresses. Fanucci won't take a dime less than $300. We'll have to pay."
Vito was astonished, but was careful not to show his astonishment.
"Why do we have to pay him? What can he do to the three of us? We're stronger than him. We have guns. Why do we have to hand over the money we earned?"
Clemenza explained patiently.
"Fanucci has friends, real brutes. He has connections with the police. He'd like us to tell him our plans because he could set us up for the cops and earn their gratitude. Then they would owe him a favor. That's how he operates. And he has a license from Maranzella himself to work this neighborhood."
Maranzella was a gangster often in the newspapers, reputed to be the leader of a criminal ring specializing in extortion, gambling, and armed robbery. Clemenza served wine that he had made himself. His wife, after putting a plate of salami, olives, and a loaf of Italian bread on the table, went down to sit with her women cronies in front of the building, carrying her chair with her. She was a young Italian girl, only a few years in the country, and did not yet understand English. Vito Corleone sat with his two friends and drank wine. He had never used his intelligence before as he was using it now. He was surprised at how clearly he could think. He recalled everything he knew about Fanucci. He remembered the day the man had had his throat cut and had run down the street holding his fedora under his chin to catch the dripping blood. He remembered the murder of the man who had wielded the knife and the other two having their sentences removed by paying an indemnity. And suddenly, he was sure that Fanucci had no great connections, could not possibly have. Not a man who informed to the police. Not a man who allowed his vengeance to be bought off. A real mafioso chief would have had the other two men killed also. No. Fanucci had got lucky and killed one man, but had known he could not kill the other two after they were alerted. And so, he had allowed himself to be paid. It was the personal brutal force of the man that allowed him to levy tribute on the shopkeepers, the gambling games that ran in the tenement apartments, but Vito Corleone knew of at least one gambling game that had never paid Fanucci tributes, and nothing had ever happened to the man running it. And so, it was Fanucci alone, or Fanucci with some gunman hired for special jobs on a strictly cash basis, which left Vito Corleone with another decision: the course his own life must take. It was from this experience came his oft-repeated belief that every man has but one destiny. On that night, he could have paid Fanucci the tribute and have become again a grocery clerk with perhaps his own grocery store in the years to come. But destiny had decided that he was to become a don and had brought Fanucci to him to set him on his destined path. When they finished the bottle of wine, Vito said cautiously to Clemenza and Tessio,
"If you like, why not give me $200 each to pay to Fanucci? I guarantee he will accept that amount from me. Then leave everything in my hands. I'll settle this problem to your satisfaction."
At once Clemenza's eyes gleamed with suspicion. Vito said to him coldly,
"I never lie to people I have accepted as my friends. Speak to Fanucci yourself tomorrow. Let him ask you for the money, but don't pay him, and don't in any way quarrel with him. Tell him you have to get the money and will give it to me to give him. Let him understand that you are willing to pay what he asks. Don't bargain. I'll quarrel over the price with him. There's no point making him angry with us if he's as dangerous a man as you say he is."